Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zemer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by our Director of Religious Education, Karen Lapidus, our Music Director, Hal Walker, the Fallowtime Folk Orchestra and Golden Tones Junior Choir, and also by representatives of our membership committee, including the chair, Claudia Miller, who are helping to celebrate our new member in gathering this morning.
May our challenge shine all through our lives. May our challenge shine all through our lives. May our hearts be open. May our minds be still. May our truth be spoken. May our lives fulfill this promise of peace, this promise of peace, this promise of peace, this promise of peace.
Ourselves from the demands and delights of the daily round, from the dirty dishes and unwaxed floors, from unmowed grass and untrimmed bushes, for all incompletenesses and not yet startednesses, from the unholy and the unresolved. We summon ourselves to attend to our vision of peace and justice, of cleanliness and health, of delight and devotion, of the lovely and the holy, of who we are and what we can do. We summon the power of tradition and the exhilaration of newness, the wisdom of the ages, and the knowing of the very young. We summon beauty, eloquence, poetry, and music to be the bearers of our dreams. We would open our eyes, our ears, our minds, our hearts to the amplest dimensions of life. We rejoice in manifold promises and possibilities. Come, let us worship together.
It is our great joy this morning to welcome 19 new members and their children to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent. Our in-gathering ceremony is an opportunity for us to recognize all of our new members and celebrate the contributions they will make to this community and their presence among us. Karen Lapidus has a few words to say.
When we decide to join a group, it usually means that we want to add that membership to our identity. Being a part of a group often defines who we are. For example, if you join a soccer team, you become a soccer player. If you join a Girl Scout troop, you become a Girl Scout. And today, the people who will stand before you are joining the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent because they want to be Unitarian Universalists. They want that religious identity to be their religious identity. And although our church rules state that a member must be at least 14 years old, the children and youth of our newest members belong to us and we to them as well. We welcome the children of our newest members as full participants in our programs of religious education for children and youth and in any other programs of our church.
Claudia Miller, our chair of our membership committee, will lead us in our in-gathering celebration.
May religion be to us life, integrity, service, and joy. We welcome you. We welcome you to this religious community to share in the celebration of life with us and the comfort of knowing that you are not on this journey alone. Our hope is that you embrace wholeheartedly both the privileges and the responsibilities bestowed by membership in our church. I will now read with gratitude the names of all our new members and their families. When your name is called, you and your family may come forward and join us in the chancel. Please bring your insert from the order of service with you. David Brown.
And his daughter Emily.
Richard DeLuca. Bill Droll, Joe Fatchett, Jenner Fizette and Teresa Walton,
and their son Quinn Barker,
Ian Hogan, Vivian Hogan,
and their daughter Juniper,
Kim Hampshire,
and her sons David and Jack Hampshire,
Larry Johnson,
and his children Zachary and Merlin Johnson,
Nicole Polster,
and her children, Dean and June Polster.
Arch Ritchie, Susan Ritchie, Laura Sinclair, Sarah Verity, Larry Killian, Sylvia Killian.
To lead us into a time of silence, meditation, and prayer, these words from the poet Mae Sarton from her work, Recovering a Journal. I would like to believe when I die that I have given myself away like a tree that sows its seeds every spring and never counts the loss, because it's not loss. It's adding to the future life. It's the tree's way of being, strongly rooted perhaps, but spilling its treasure out into the wind. And now, surrounded by the sounds of our community, we in this space we'll keep silence together for a couple of minutes. And I invite you to join with me now in the spirit of prayer. When I stand in my yard and look upon the trees, I see to one side a buckeye and a big, beautiful oak to the other. As I look upon those trees, I'm reminded that it's not only in springtime that trees release their seeds. O Spirit of life and of love, as we gather here on the cusp of autumn, may the autumn trees be our teachers. For there's so much in life we seek to cling to, hold on to, control. But the trees remind us that sometimes it's time to release, to let go, to spread our seeds into the wind. May the trees remind us and give us courage. For the truth is, release is not always only an ending. Sometimes it's also the seed of a new beginning. May it be so, and amen. Our reading today is a reading I'd like to invite you to join me in. It is from Chief Dan George. That's his picture. You may recognize him as he was an actor in many, many Hollywood movies in his lifetime. But he was originally from Canada and the chief of the Tsleil-Waututh Indian Nation in British Columbia. And he was deeply committed to the health and wholeness of Native peoples and of the planet. And these are his words. Will you please join me in reading them together? The time will soon be here when my grandchild will long for the cry of a loon, the flash of a salmon, the whisper of spruce needles, or the screech of an eagle. But he will not make friends with any of these creatures, and when his heart aches with longing, he will curse me. Have I done all to keep the air fresh? Have I cared enough about the water? Have I left the eagle to soar in freedom? Have I done everything I could to earn my grandchild's fondness? This summer, when I was in New England with my family, I found myself with about an hour or so when our son Rylan and I needed to wait for my spouse Evan. And he was tired of being constrained in a car seat, so I noticed we were near a public library and decided that would be a good place to play. We walked in, and lo and behold, arrayed before me was the library book sale. So I thought I'd peruse the titles for a few minutes, but Rylan didn't think that was a very good idea at all. And the time was limited, so I knew I needed to let him go play. So I pulled myself away from the books, but as I did, I noticed this one and picked it up because I loved the title to bring it with me, Faith in a Seed by Henry David Thoreau. It's the first publication of Thoreau's last manuscript, which was published in the middle 1800s. I didn't even have time to read the back of the book, but I brought it home with me. And as I was preparing for this service, I remembered that title and decided to flip through. As I was perusing the book, which reads like a journal of Thoreau's own efforts to read the forests and the fields near his home, I came across a passage spanning several pages in which he discusses his observations of the asclepias plants, which you know probably as milkweed. He begins detailing his observation of the mature milkweed pod of the fine silvery white thread it contains. He notes the conditions which seem to cause the pods to split and disperse their seeds, and then he writes this, which strikes me more as the words of a poet than of a citizen scientist. He writes, "Thus from generation to generation the seeds go, bounding over lakes and woods and meadows. How many myriad miles go they sailing, high over hill and meadow and river, on various tracks, until the wind lulls and they plant their race in a new locality. Who can tell how many miles away? I do not see, but the seeds which are ripened in New England may plant themselves in Pennsylvania. At any rate, I am interested in the fate or success of every such venture which the autumn sends forth. And for this end, these silkum streamers have been perfecting themselves all summer, a prophecy not only of the fall, but of future springs. Who could believe in prophecies that the world would end this summer while one milkweed with faith matured its seeds?" It was his neighbors who were prophesying that the world would end that summer, a man named Daniel, and this is his response. All these years later, we too should be keenly interested in the milkweed, because it is upon milkweed that monarch butterflies depend. And as you've surely heard, there have been alarming drops in the population of monarchs overwintering in Mexico for the last 3 years, and before that, for the last 2 decades, a steady decline in their number. The primary threat to these butterflies include herbicides and pesticides, climate change, and habitat loss. In generations past, monarchs could count on finding milkweed in the edges of fields and even in the middle of fields on their migratory journey. But because of the development of Roundup-ready crops, most of the industrial agricultural fields in this country these days are just acres and acres of whatever has been planted, corn or soybeans, with no weeds to be found, no milkweed. The monarchs that actually make it to their overwintering grounds in Mexico each year face challenges there as well, challenges from logging and development which have destroyed much of their habitat. And then on top of that, there are threats of the milkweed being lost because of drought and threats to the butterflies of severe storms in Mexico, both which can be linked to the consequences of climate change. Everyone who loves monarch butterflies has cause to be concerned about their future, but truly it isn't just monarchs we have to worry about. Many have said that the monarchs are actually functioning for us like a canary in the coal mine. The biologist and founder of Monarch Watch, Chip Taylor, explains that monarchs live in habitat that supports many pollinators, including small ground mammals and birds, ground nesting birds. And if we lose the monarchs, chances are good we're going to lose many of those ground nesting pollinators. And if we lose those pollinators, we're going to lose a lot of plants and a lot of the organisms that depend on those plants, and on it goes. As we all know, everything is interconnected. To combat these challenges, there are many organizations devoted to educating people about the importance of milkweed and encouraging us to plant it wherever we can, on grounds of churches and schools and parks and playgrounds and commercial landscapes, on farms, at least on the edges of farms and gardens, and most especially on the corridors and highways, the stretch of land that separates the highways. There are even organizations that will give away free milkweed seeds to anyone who will promise to plant them. So if you're interested, all you have to do is put free milkweed seeds into Google and you'll get connected. It seems that, like Thoreau, we too have ample cause for faith in a seed. I have to tell you, after the first service, one of the religious education teachers told me, I didn't know this, that their class last week released butterflies out in the play space back behind the church. And they told the kids that there's a tradition among some people to make a wish whenever butterflies are released. And so they invited the kids to make a wish. And the teacher told me that the most common wish of the children, the one wished most often, was for there to be more butterflies. There's an ancient story in the Midrash of an old man, already 100 years old, who was observed planting a fig tree. When some passersby wandered along, they scoffed at him. "What are you doing, old man? By the time that tree bears fruit, you will be long gone." To which he replied, "My ancestors planted for me. I was born into a world flourishing with ready pleasures, and so now I plant for my children." Whether we're planting milkweed or trees or the sure knowledge that they're loved in the heart of a child, planting is an act of faith. It's an act of faith in a future that we may not live to see. And it's also a promise. Planting is a promise that we will do what we can to help ensure that the future is bright. The future needs our promises now more than ever. Climate change threatens tragedy and suffering for us and catastrophe for future generations if we do not act. And you know this already. Right now, there worst consequences of climate change are already affecting the most vulnerable people, the poorest people of the world who are least responsible for the damage. And those of us in most developed nations have a moral obligation to pressure our governments to work to reduce the harm so that Earth can recover. We owe this to one another, absolutely, and we owe it to future generations. And scientists have warned us unequivocally, if we do not act, our failure will echo across time. And we know this already, too. And I believe that most of us are so heartsick and afraid that it can become immobilizing. How do we talk of this? And what do we do? Well, we know that we have to do something. because we want the people of the future to inherit a beautiful planet. We want them to have clean water and lush forests and wide, unpolluted skies. We want them to know the beauty of the monarch and the majesty of the wilderness. Our speaker, who was here on Wednesday evening talking to us about the conservation efforts for the Red Rock Wilderness area, told us that when they began their efforts 30 years ago, there was something like 9 million acres of land that they had designated as potentially as wilderness area that deserved protection. And in that 30 years already, because of many threats, logging, development, mining, off-road vehicles, already that number is smaller because some of that land no longer qualifies as wilderness. And this breaks our hearts because we want our children to have a beautiful future, to be able to go camping in the Red Rock Wilderness area if they want and look up at a canopy of stars. We want them to have opportunity to wonder at the colors of coral and at the majesty of roaming elephants. We want the ones who come after us to have a good chance for a good life. So we do what we can. Most of us have already made many changes to the way we live our lives because we know that we must be part of the change. And so we recycle and we turn off the water when we brush our teeth and we bring bags with us when we go to the grocery store and we've switched our light bulbs to energy efficient light bulbs. And every time Earth Day rolls around, we're presented with more lists and tips of things we can do to help save the planet. And many of us look at those lists and dutifully try to make changes in whatever ways that we can. And this is good, and it's important and necessary, and it's not enough. Because the truth is that individually, even acting, many of us, it's not enough to solve the problems of climate change. For lasting change, we need the collaboration of world leaders, of business leaders. And that's why this big climate march that Fred mentioned earlier is happening right as we speak. So we're there in spirit. It's in New York City. I wish I could have been there today. Organizers are saying that this is going to be the largest climate march in history. They're expecting hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. And there are over 1,400 partnering organizations from indigenous communities, faith communities, families, schools, students, labor unions, environmental justice organizations, peace organizations, scientists, municipalities, businesses, and more. And as a way to help make clear that concern about climate change spans every area of life, the organizers told people when they lined up this morning that they could choose to march individually wherever they wanted to, or they could join with a cohort of people that they identified with. And so there's this big map online that says, if you want to march with all the scientists are meeting here. If you want to march with the faith communities, they're meeting here. If you want to march with the peace organizations, they're meeting here. And the hope is that in the photographs that come out and the press that comes later today and in the days that come, we will see broad swaths of people from every area of life gathered together to say that we need to do something about climate change. But the thing is that it's not just this event in New York today. The organizers have also collaborated with 158 other countries to have climate change events at the same time. And there are 2,700 events scheduled to coincide with this climate march in New York. The goal is to proclaim as clearly as possible that it's still possible to change the course of the future and to create, in the words of the mobilizing call, a world with an economy that works for people and the planet, a world safe from the ravages of climate change, a world with good jobs, clean air, clean water, and healthy communities. So this march is happening right now, and a member of our congregation, Mary Lou Holly, and her friend Michael Lee are there on our behalf. The reason the march is happening right now is because of another event that's happening on Tuesday. This one is at the United Nations, and it was called by General Ban Ki-moon. It's called the Climate Summit. And as of Friday, there were over 120 heads of state and government committed to attend the climate summit, which the United Nations says will make it the largest gathering of world leaders working on climate change ever. The organizers understand that there are limits to what can be accomplished in one day. It's just a one-day event. But they've challenged every delegate from every country attending to come with at least one bold proposal, one innovative idea of something that they can do concretely in their nation to help face the problem of climate change. And the organizers hope that as they present these ideas to one another, new collaborations will form. And they hope that this will lead to some concrete promises at the next scheduled climate justice gathering of world leaders, which is scheduled for early 2015. And here is where you can become involved, because in addition to hearing from all of the world leaders who will be at this climate summit on Tuesday, the United Nations has this enormous social media team. And for the last several months, they have been putting out on social media information and encouragement for people to participate in this climate summit by posting on social media. And they've already had 33 million people participate using the hashtag Climate2014. And on Tuesday, there's going to be an enormous screen at the United Nations that all the world leaders can see while they're there doing their business and making their statements. And it's going to be scrolling all of the posts and tweets that anybody around the world makes using that hashtag, Climate2014. So at the same time that they're presenting their ideas, they will hear ideas from people all around the world. And so I encourage you, if you're on any kind of social media, that are on every major platform, to sometime between today and the end of the day on Tuesday, post something, your encouragement, to all those people gathered using that hashtag, Climate2014, to say that you need them to act, and you're offering their encouragement. I'm going to make my post later today, and I'll be linking to a document that was originally conceived by the conservationist Jacques Cousteau in the early 1900s. It's called the Bill of Rights for Future Generations. Since it was developed, it's been signed by over 9 million people, and UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, joined as a partner. This document, this Bill of Rights for Future Generations, has five articles. The five articles declare that future generations have a right to an undamaged earth, that we who are alive now are the trustees who must act to ensure that they receive an undamaged earth as their inheritance, that we are responsible for assessing the risk involved in the collective choices we make about how we'll live on the planet, and that we must not sacrifice the rights of the future in order to make life easier for us today. Some of you may have already known about this Bill of Rights. I didn't know about it. And the way that I discovered it was actually by a Canadian organization called A Promise to Future Generations, who created that PowerPoint that I shared with you. This is a group of Canadian students who were learning about this Bill of Rights to Future Generations, and they have adapted it, just slightly updated it, so it reflects some of the growing awareness that we have now, these years later, after the original Bill of Rights was written. And they are encouraging people all across Canada to have signing ceremonies of this promise to future generations, to come together in public and witness one another signing this document, witness one another's pledge. There's a common thread behind all of these things, all of these ways of acting and engaging. At the Climate March today and the Climate Summit on Tuesday, the message is that we have to act together because we're one world. During the citizen engagement on the subject of climate change on social media and during ceremonies in which people publicly make a promise to future generations, the message is we need to witness one another, to hear one another's concerns, and act together. Individual actions are important and necessary, yes, but they're not sufficient. We can't do this on our own. We need cooperation and collaboration if we're going to succeed in preserving a livable planet for the future. And we also need bold leaders who will do the hard work that change requires. So offer them your encouragement and let us pray that they will take whatever risk is necessary in order to ensure that together we can fulfill the promise. May it be so, and amen. Will the ushers please come forward? There's a beautiful Welsh proverb. A seed hidden in the heart of every apple is an orchard invisible. A seed hidden in the heart of every apple is an orchard invisible. We are here today because of planting that people did before us. The founders of this congregation 148 years ago planted a seed. They could not see what would come of it, but they imagined it into being, and they tended it when it was their time and people after them, and now it's our time. If you're our guest today, there's a candle in the basket. We're glad that you're with us. The offering will now be gratefully received. It is a beautiful day here on the cusp of autumn. The blue-green hills of Hearth embrace us, and let us embrace them in return, finding a way to walk gently. Go in peace. Amen.